is the news.
The death toll from Israeli air and artillery strikes on the Gaza Strip exceeds 20,000, with at least 8,000 children among the victims. UN Security Council postpones a vote on a bid to send humanitarian aid to Gaza for the third time amid a threat of veto by the United States. And the military wing Hamas says its fighters have destroyed over 40 Israeli military vehicles and killed dozens of the regime's forces in the past 3 days. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. This is our top story for this half hour. It's day 76 of the Israeli genocidal campaign in Gaza, and the regime goes ahead with its onslaught on the blockaded territory.
Mama! Mama!
The Palestine Red Crescent Society says Israeli forces keep laying siege to an ambulance center belonging to a medical charity in northern Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp. The city of Deir al-Bala in central Gaza has also seen constant communication blackouts preventing medics, first responders, and firefighters from reaching targeted areas. In the south, the Israeli regime has ordered the immediate evacuation of several areas in Khan Yunis. On Wednesday, at least 55 civilians were killed and many others injured in numerous airstrikes there. The overall death toll from Israel's onslaught on Gaza now exceeds 20,000, including at least 8,000 children. The territory is also witnessing outbreaks of infectious diseases, including diarrhea. People in Gaza are calling for complete ceasefire as Israel's relentless airstrikes and shelling have displaced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and left them without food, water, and other basic amenities. Let's take a listen to some of the displaced Palestinians in the city of Rafah narrating about their harrowing experience.
I wish for a complete ceasefire and to put an end to the series of deaths and suffering. It's been more than 76 days. People are still getting killed. There are still people under the rubble. And there are people in Gaza I still don't know anything about them. And the communication is cut.
I wish for a ceasefire so we will be able to return to our home, to our loved ones.
People are tired. They don't have any more energy. We wish that the ceasefire procedures go easy and smooth so that calm and peace prevail in all the Palestinian territories.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
Palestinian professor in Al-Azhar University, Mohammed Abu Saada, blames the international community for its failure to end the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Let's take a listen.
Let me say that it's very unfortunate that all that number of Palestinians have been killed and injured, the destruction that have been inflicted on the Gaza Strip over the past 76 days. And unfortunately, the international community has so far failed miserably, to be frank with you, to put an end to this onslaught against the Palestinian civilian population in the Gaza Strip. Over more than 2 months and a half, Israel has targeted hospitals, clinics, schools, even UN-run schools, which have been housing Palestinian displaced in the south of Gaza. It has targeted civilian infrastructure. And above all of that, there is mass starvation among the more than 2.3 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, because Israel also is blocking the entry of humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians. According to UNICEF, 60% of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip right now are suffering from starvation. And also, according to UNICEF, the UN organization, Gaza has become the worst place for children all over the world.
The UN says the disturbing allegations emerge that Israeli forces summarily killed nearly a dozen Palestinian men in Gaza City in what may amount to a war crime. A report by the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied Palestinian territory says the incident took place in Gaza's Al Ramal neighborhood on Tuesday. According to witness accounts, the regime's forces separated men from the women and children and then shot and killed at least 11 men in front of their loved ones. The deliberate targeting and killing of civilians in Gaza had also been reported before. The UN agency warns that the allegations raise the alarm about the possible commission of a war crime. It says Israel must immediately probe these allegations and bring those responsible to justice. The Israeli occupation forces have yet to comment on the incident. The UN has confirmed the killings, although the details are still under verification. Diplomatic wrangling in the UN Security Council has caused a vote on a draft resolution calling for ceasefire in Gaza to be postponed to Thursday. Diplomatic sources say the delay on the vote was at the behest of the United States. The resolution, sponsored by the United Arab Emirates, calls for the urgent suspension of hostilities to allow safe and unhindered humanitarian access to Gaza, as well as steps toward a sustainable ceasefire. The 15-member council has been grappling for days to find a common ground on the draft. The U.S., Israel's main backer, and a permanent Security Council member had vetoed two previous resolutions on Gaza. The U.S. has used its veto power at least 34 times to block U.N. resolutions that were critical of Israel. And the military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says its fighters have destroyed 41 Israeli military vehicles during the latest round of retaliatory operations against the regime. The Al-Ghassan Brigade said resistance fighters have also killed 25 Israeli soldiers and injured dozens more since Monday. This brings to 134 the number of Israeli soldiers killed since the start of the regime's ground operation in Gaza. Palestinian fighters attacked Israeli forces' command centers and military gatherings with mortar shells and short-range missiles. The brigades also reported that it fired a barrage of rockets at Tel Aviv and a settlement in the northern part of the occupied territories. Al-Ghassam has also released a video unveiling a new sniper rifle manufactured indigenously. A U.S.-based monitoring group says Palestinian fighters are continuing to use, quote, sophisticated tactics in their battles with Israeli forces. Israeli forces have carried out fresh violent raids overnight in several towns and villages across the occupied West Bank. Earlier, our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil told us more about intensified Israeli raids in the occupied territories.
Last night, Israeli forces had raided the town of Hussein in Bethlehem, and the soldiers raided a number of Palestinian homes, and they immediately used their guns to disperse the Palestinians. Israeli forces have opened fire at Palestinians in order to disperse them, and they shot and killed 18-year-old Mahmoud Zaloul from Hussein Bethlehem. 17 others had been wounded, according to Palestinian paramedics. At least two of them were in serious condition. The Palestinian Ministry of Health said that the Israelis have killed 303 Palestinians across the occupied West Bank since the Israeli war on the Gaza Strip started on the 7th of October. Early on Thursday, Israeli troops raided again Bethlehem, and they detained at least 9 Palestinians. The Israeli troops had raided again the city of Al-Khalil and arrested 2. We have to mention that yesterday, Israeli soldiers killed a Palestinian while he was in his vehicle at one of the military checkpoints, the junction of Beit Anun in Al-Khalil. Israeli forces have raided Tulkarem. Clashes had been erupted between Palestinian fighters and the Israeli forces. According to Palestinian resistance groups, the Palestinian fighters clashed with the Israeli soldiers. The Israeli troops have detained at least 2 from Tulkarem. At the end of the day, the Palestinian Prisoner Society said that 25 Palestinians had been detained by the Israeli soldiers only since the early hours of Thursday.
Areas along Lebanon's southern border frequently witnessed exchanges of fire between the Hezbollah resistance movement and Israel since October the 8th. That's the day after Israel began its deadly onslaught on Gaza. There are reports of new clashes that have resulted in the death of one person in Lebanon. our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, joins us now with more details. Mariam?
Yes, we've actually confirmed that there is a martyrdom of a woman in the town of Marun al-Ras. That was the result, of course, of the overnight and the morning shelling from the Israelis. Hezbollah had, of course, retaliated. In the middle of the night, we had two different retaliations at 15 past midnight and 12:30 also at night. We had two different launching of rockets, one against the settlement of Kiryat Shmona, which Hezbollah has insisted on naming in its original Palestinian name, which is the town of Khalsa. And they have said that they hit and scored their targets. We also know from Israeli cameras that the rockets hit and actually reached that settlement. And Hezbollah said in the statement that this is in response to the targeting of civilians in several towns, including Kfar Kila. There was a destruction of a house. And also in Marun al-Ras, we had the targeting of the house. There was a woman who was martyred, as we said. Her husband is also injured, severely injured, but he is still alive. So therefore, we have a new civilian martyr. Hezbollah will probably even retaliate once again, since this comes, the martyrdom of the woman came after even that that operation. The operation against Kiryat Shmona was only in response for the destruction of civilian houses. But there was also another issue, which is new. Hezbollah said in the statement that they will shoot and retaliate reciprocally depending on the Israeli aggression. So once the Israelis destroy civilian houses, once they kill civilians, then Hezbollah will respond and will make sure to continue their retaliation until there is a reciprocal response and they know for sure that they have done the equation that Hezbollah Secretary General has put before, that a civilian for a civilian. Now it's even a tree for a tree. So even when the Israelis launched their attack against the area of Al-Rahib, where we had also a natural reserve, Hezbollah made sure also to target the Branit settlement. That was the second operation that occurred in the middle of the night, where they also said they targeted what was a forestation, or basically a group of trees, in order to say that whatever the Israelis do, of course, we will reciprocate and we will definitely respond and retaliate in the same way. And it seems that the Israelis are extending their aggressions. We have more destruction of houses, more than we did in the first round. And we can see that very evidently, even in the towns that are not adjacent to the border. They're a bit further off. Other than that, of course, we still have the continuous shellings of towns like Marun al-Ras, like Ayt al-Shaab. We mentioned yesterday how in Marun al-Ras, they continuously targeted the national park, which is named after the Islamic Republic of Iran, because it was a donation from the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we have very few natural parks. This is one of the main natural parks in South Lebanon, which hundreds of families visit, especially in the summertime and in the spring. And so that was one of the places where the Israelis targeted, evidently targeting all forms of life. And so they also have targeted areas in Yarun, in Ramya, and all along the border, actually, in addition to those that are a bit further off, like we said, like Shakra and so on. These are towns that are a bit further from the border. So, of course, the tit-for-tat confrontations continue, while Hezbollah has made it clear that as long as the Israelis trespass or they continue to go beyond the boundaries that Hezbollah has drawn, and Hezbollah will also launch their rockets further off from the border. We can see even from their operations yesterday and the day before that they are being very meticulous on making sure that they target the posts where the Israelis are, even the new posts that have been situated by the Israeli army, thinking that they are going further off and maybe going away from the eyes of the resistance. Still, Hezbollah was able to monitor, and with continuous observation, they were able to know the movement of the soldiers and target them. Of course, today we're still waiting to see if there will be another retaliation from Hezbollah or the other resistance operations throughout the border, which is something, of course, that continues on a daily basis.
All right, thanks a lot. Mariam Saleh joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Moving on, Yemeni leader Abdelmalek al-Houthi says military operations in the Red Sea against all Israeli-linked ships will continue despite U.S. and Israeli threats.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi, delivered a televised speech addressing the latest developments and military operations in the Red Sea. He said Yemeni forces will continue to target Israeli-owned and Israeli-bound ships in support of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, but added that they will pose no threat to other merchant vessels cruising in the waterway.
There are no other ships or shipments that are being targeted in the Red Sea except those associated with the Israeli entity. These ships are either owned by Israelis or are used to their benefit. The operation in Bab al-Mandab, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea do not target any other ships and do not impact maritime navigation or hinder international trade for any other country.
Al-Houthi reaffirmed Yemen's armed and naval forces will continue to target and block Israeli shipments until the genocide in Palestine ends. This will continue despite U.S. and Western threats of military actions against Yemen. The United States said last week that it is building up a multinational naval task force to protect vessels transiting the Red Sea. The Ansarullah leader, however, warned the United States that Yemen will hit back if attacked by the U.S.
The biggest threat to global maritime trade and navigation in the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea are the American advancements that are militarizing these waters. They are mobilizing to transform the sea into a battlefield. They are doing this to serve the Israeli entity who called on them to take such an initiative. Those who are making a big mistake in joining the Americans in the so-called effort to protect shipping in the Red Sea should know very well that they are doing this just to protect Israeli shipping, not international shipping.
Al-Houthi concluded his televised speech by condemning Arab regimes who are fighting Yemen on behalf of the U.S. and Israel. He called on them to stand aside and allow Yemen to deal with the U.S. and Israel directly. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistant movement says that U.S. and its allies can't prevent Yemen from supporting Palestine. He has stressed that Washington, a staunch ally of Israel, should end the genocidal war in Gaza if they really want to see operations against Israeli ships in the Red Sea end. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
The U.S. has formed an anti-Yemen coalition following the country's attacks on Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea in response to the Israeli regime's onslaught against Gaza. Correspondent in the occupied West Bank, Mona Candilas, talked to the people there about the possibility of Bahrain joining the alliance.
Bahrain's position is not new. The war in Yemen that was going on for 7 years or so was initiated by Bahrain, Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. And who was supporting them? The United States. Bahrain has not been against Yemen only recently. Yemen has a greater expanse along the Red Sea, and even if Bahrain will join the coalition, they will not be able to do anything to Yemen. Yemen will excel over them.
It's a new development in the region and in the regional countries. Perhaps what is happening in Gaza, in a way or another, has influenced many people and countries, especially in the Arab world. Bahrain does not differ from other countries.
My stance extends beyond Bahrain. I'm talking about most Arab countries, because their stance is a shame. What they are doing is shameful and against the Palestinians and Palestine. All these countries have allies, and they are all against us. Only Yemen is standing with us hand in hand.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
collected in files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene, because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Brothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwandan, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim, or the hands of the victim, back to the force public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against the Congolese people for any small thing. You could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. So many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery. The oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being 24 trillion dollars. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands in unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet, in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tet is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Rain you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face. And he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in the oldest, sorry, method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers, so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule, proxy governments which are created by the foreign powers, and thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge, because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of this suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lualua, and Romelu Lukaku, their top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is, beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us. The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Welcome to IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. And this is your host, Sayyid Mustafa. In this show, we discuss many different things which aim to help us in our practical day-to-day life. And the topic that we've been discussing for the past few episodes has been related to the rights of our dear brothers and sisters in faith, right? How we should be interacting with them, what are some practical things we should be doing on a day-to-day basis. Islam is a uniquely social religion. I don't think there's any other faith or any other sort of, you know, group out there which focuses so much on the social rights of our fellow brothers and sisters. It's really incredible when you look at the books of how extensive they are when they talk about these topics, how many narrations and hadiths we have from the Prophet, how many verses of the Quran focus on this very important topic. And what we had been discussing was that there's really three ways we can help someone. The first category of help was their material needs, right? So helping them, whether it's with food, with water, with shelter, clothes, it could be educational needs, it could be helping people get married, all of those things, even, for example, giving gifts to others, these things all help create a loving atmosphere in society. Islam isn't just focusing on, you know, an individual's need. And I think that's something that needs to be discussed, that there's unfortunately, I think, a big part of this sort of globalization and the effects of westernization on our cultures is that one of the key sort of traits in Western culture is this idea of individualism, that the individual is everything, that the individual has to do everything themselves for themselves, right? Whereas Islam, one of the traits of an Islamic culture of Islam is collectivism, that we live collectively as a society, as a people, that we help each other when there is need to help each other. That you must, for example, one of the hadiths that we have is that a believer must know, for example, and unfortunately, I don't think any of us do this anymore, including myself, may God forgive me, but we must know, for example, our neighbors 40 houses in each direction from our house, right? You should know what their needs are, if they have any problems, if they have any issues. If we can't do 40 houses, I do believe that at least we should try at least one house, right? Sometimes you don't even know who our next door neighbor is, what kind of problems they're going through. One of the things that I really love, you know, about Iran is that here neighbors really do sometimes, they'll come and, you know, make dishes for you, they'll come and bring fruits for you, and they'll ask you how you're doing. So at least you know what your neighbor is going through. So apart from this, you know, helping each other materially, the other very important topic and category that we're going to be discussing is sort of helping someone on a spiritual or material level. We'll do that right after we come back from the break.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون. این هم همه امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Okay, so we're back from the break, and we've been discussing how we can sort of build a better society, you know, using Islamic principles. And one of the very key factors that we can do to help each other is to help each other on a spiritual level. There are many, many simple things that we can do. So one thing that we can, for example, do on a spiritual level to help someone is to pray for them, right? Just praying for someone is something that we've been told in the hadiths, that you should pray for your fellow brothers and sisters. When you pray for others, you know, God then also listens to your prayers. He will answer your prayers as well. You must, for example, protect the respect of your believing brother or sister. Don't, for example, insult them. Don't say things behind their back. All of these things are to help you spiritually. When you say bad things about your brother or sister, then you also, you know, you are in a way dirtying your soul. You're dirtying your tongue. And you want to protect your soul and tongue so that God's guidance and light can reach you. These things are extremely important. You know, don't think that the way we're interacting with others, you know, that they don't have a spiritual effect on us. All of the smallest actions that we do, everything that we say has an effect on us. And this actually reminds me of some stories that I heard in a very popular TV show here in Iran. It airs on Channel 4 from, you know, the state channel here. It's called Zindagi Pas Az Zindagi, which means life after life. And in this show, people who have had near-death experiences, they come and talk about, you know, what happened to them. One of the most common things that you will find, I've watched probably at least 50 to 60 episodes of the show, and the most common theme in this show, I would say, people say one of the things that we had the most difficulties with, the things that we were asked about the most when we were in that afterlife sort of world, is the rights of others. Others people's rights are so important to the point where we're told in narrations that God can forgive us for individual sins that we commit for against ourselves. But if we've taken the right of someone else, God will not forgive us for that sin until that person forgives us. So for example, if you owe someone money and you don't pay them back, you know, and you pray for forgiveness, God says, I'm not going to forgive you until that person is satisfied with you. Until that person, either you return that person's money or that person forgives you. At that point, I am willing to forgive you. Right? So this is not something to be taken lightly. And, you know, what I find amazing in all of this is that this concept is not something that is just really confined to our religion. You find that in all societies, people have this concept of helping others. For example, you'll find the word karma is used in many other societies and religions. Right now, what does karma mean? It means that what goes around comes back to you. What karma means is that any good that you do in this world, it will come back to you. And any bad that you do, it will come back to you as well. And we find traditions which say the very same thing, I would say, in that when you help others, God says he will reward you, he will answer your prayers, he will forgive you. But if you do not help your fellow brothers and sisters and you are in a position to help them, God says, you know, I will not forgive you. I really hope that we all reach a point where we're able to help others, whether it's materially, whether it's spiritually. And I hope that God helps us protect the rights of others, that we don't become of those people that are asked about, you know, the rights of others on the day of judgment. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode and this topic. And please pray for the betterment of our ummah, of our society, that we all learn to obey these rules and principles and apply them in our lives. Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.